pronouncing the name right, Duong Mala. We'll have 25 minutes of argument by attorney Robert R. Flatley of Will and Flatley of Green Bay, Wisconsin, who is representing the defendant. We'll then have 30 minutes by Shanette T. Campbell, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, who will argue on behalf of the state, and then a five-minute rebuttal by Attorney Flatley. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I want to express my appreciation to the court for coming to northeastern Wisconsin. I think this does provide an excellent opportunity for the public, particularly the students here, to learn more about the workings of our judicial system. So I'm glad to see you here.
Made your trip a lot shorter.
Well, I wasn't going to mention that. Well, first of all, I'm representing Siscombe, I think it's Dugmalia, although I'm not sure of the pronunciation either. He is a defendant, appellate petitioner in this case. The issue before the court today is, in this case, is was Siscombe Dugmalia entitled to withdraw his plea of no contest because he was not advised by the trial court and did not know or understand that a plea of no contest could result in his deportation. First of all, I think you have to have a little background on Siscombe. He was born in Laos, was not a United States citizen. He came to this country as a young boy with his family. He was one of 13 children. He lived with his mother and some of his brothers and sisters. The family only spoke Laotian at home. In fact, his mother and some of his brothers and sisters still don't speak English. He dropped out of school in the ninth grade. At hearings in this matter, he testified that he didn't understand English very well, has trouble reading English, can read little words but not big words. His trial attorney at a post-conviction motion hearing testified that his communication and language skills were primitive, that his language was street language, that he was not sophisticated in vocabulary or grammar, and that he didn't understand legal terms. With his limited understanding of English and his limited education, he became involved in gang activities at an early age. On March 18, 1988, at the age of 18, he allegedly participated with several other young individuals in the commission of several felonies. He was arrested the same day and has been in custody ever since, either in jail or prison. On September 21, 1998, at the age of 19, he entered a plea of no contest to three felony charges. Now, prior to entering his no contest plea, his trial attorney helped him fill out a three-page questionnaire for the court, which is entitled Request to Enter Plea and Waiver of Rights, and is in the appendix to my brief. There were 24 questions on this form. Question 17 on page 2, read in part, I understand that if I am not a citizen of the United States, a plea of no contest may result in deportation. There is no explanation of the meaning of the word deportation, and no other reference to deportation in that document. At the post-conviction motion hearing, Siscombe's trial attorney testified that her practice would have been to read the questionnaire to him and then have him initial each paragraph. She has no independent recollection or had anything in her notes about any explanation of the meaning of deportation being given to him in her context with him.
Counsel, now, that's what happened here, and so he initialed paragraph 17.
Yes, he did.
And then there was what we call an evidentiary hearing or the post-trial hearing where he came back before the judge, and the judge heard the testimony, which we have part of that in our memos to this court. Are you trying to say that here we know that he had a ninth grade education and he himself said, well, he understood perhaps 20%. The court knew that, but then they proceeded to go ahead. Was that, they proceeded to go ahead and take the plea?
I think it's partially correct. The court didn't realize at the time of the plea hearing, the court had some of this knowledge. A lot of this came out at the post-conviction motion hearing.
But what I'm getting at is that his lawyer, when we came back, so the court, first of all, took the plea, the Bangard plea, which is standard. It was in writing. And you're asking this court, of course, to allow him to withdraw the plea and then go back and try this case again.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Now, what impact, in my opinion, or in your opinion, rather, is that going to have? Are you saying he should have had an interpreter? Should he be at that time? He didn't understand, and what is your basis for his lack of understanding?
Well, if he didn't interpret it, probably would have been very advantageous. At one point, he did request an interpreter. They couldn't locate one. He then waived the interpreter. That was an early stage of the proceedings. All through the record, there's indications that he had some limited understanding of English.
But then he waived.
He waived the interpreter in the record.
Counsel, where in the record did he waive the interpreter?
This would have been at the time of before the preliminary hearing, when he waived his preliminary hearing before the court commissioner. At one point, there was a request for an interpreter, and
they looked for one for about a couple of weeks, didn't they?
They looked for one, and they could not find one. And then this was just a waiver of the preliminary hearing, and at that point, he said he was going to proceed without one.
Counsel, waiver of the preliminary hearing. As I read the transcript, and boy, I sure can be wrong, but I have it in front of me. First of all, the waiver of an interpreter, the law requires it to be a personal waiver, knowing and voluntary. Is that correct?
I believe so, yes.
I believe I have the entire transcript of the waiver of the preliminary hearing before me. And as I recall reading this, and again, I can be wrong, so do correct me. It starts out by saying that we attempted to locate an interpreter, were unsuccessful in doing so, and the interpreters available to us don't want to interpret. They were refusing. The attorney explains that. And then the court asks the defendant the following questions. Do you have any questions about the information on this questionnaire that I've been given? No. I didn't see anything here on the waiver, personal waiver by the defendant of the preliminary hearing. Was there was it a written thing that was done rather than verbal, and then
if I recall correctly from the transcript, it was verbal.
Okay, well, I'll allow you to continue.
This is before the court commission at the preliminary hearing. There was not a request later on in the proceedings for an interpreter. Unfortunately, I suspect an interpreter had been appointed at some stage. Some of the problems here might have been avoided. But read an initial question 17 in page 2 that says in part, I understand that if I'm not a citizen of the United States, a plea of no contest may result in deportation.
Well, counsel, are you claiming to this court that your client did not know that he could be deported?
Yes.
He did not have any actual knowledge.
He contends, he testified at hearings, that he didn't understand what the word deportation meant when it was brought up, that it was never explained to him, and that he didn't know that he could be sent back to Laos if he entered a no contest plea. He said he first learned about deportation when he was served deportation papers after he was in prison. And he contended that he would not have entered a no contest plea if he had known that he could be deported back to Laos.
Mr. Flatley, one of the major conflicts that I saw that you had with the state, at least in your briefs, related to the standard of review. And I know you've taken the position that it's a two-step review here, and that basically the court can look at the ultimate issue de novo. The state has taken the position that we should be looking at whether there was an erroneous exercise of discretion by the trial court here. Would you explain why you feel you're correct and the state is wrong on the standard of review?
Well, I believe there are court decisions to the effect that this is a issue of whether a person has entered a plea knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently is a constitutional question, is a constitutional right, and that in such situations, constitutional mandate that he enter the plea in that manner, and that under such circumstances, the court then looks at the whole record to see whether it was established by clear and convincing evidence that he understood his rights. It's not just review of the appellate court's decision to see whether it was proper. It's really an examination of the whole subject.
So that while you're zeroing in on the deportation issue and his understanding of deportation, you're actually claiming then that this was not a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary plea. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. If he didn't understand what deportation meant, he really couldn't knowingly and voluntarily and intelligently enter a plea that might send him back to Laos. And I think that's really the major issue here.
Counsel, I'm going to ask you when you sit down for after your argument and before rebuttal, and I'm also going to ask your opposing counsel to assist me, because after having read the waiver of the preliminary hearing again, I still don't find any waiver of interpreter, and so I must be missing something. But I find the waiver of a preliminary hearing, but there has been no waiver of an interpreter as I read it. But maybe I'm missing something.
That might be. I didn't represent him in the trial level.
Mm-hmm.
I know there was a discussion. Look at the transcript.
If there is no waiver at the waiver of preliminary hearing, no waiver of an interpreter, is there any place else in the record that you are positing contains a waiver of an interpreter?
No, I don't believe there would be. I don't recall from reviewing the transcripts that ever coming up after that point.
If there is no waiver of an interpreter, is that a problem?
Well, I thought it was. It was raised to the Court of Appeals, and they felt that it wasn't a problem and denied relief on that.
In what way was it raised in the Court of Appeals?
It was raised on initial. This has been the Court of Appeals twice.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the first time, that was one of the issues that he should have had an interpreter. The Court of Appeals rejected that, but did remand the case to the trial court for a hearing on the manner in which he entered his plea to determine whether
he had actual knowledge.
Actual knowledge. And that was the only issue then that remained, and the only issue that remained when it came to this court.
I assume that if he had actual knowledge, that he understood it, mm-hmm. and that his English was good enough. I mean, that's the implicit
yes,
in the finding,
mm-hmm.
knowledge.
That basically, yeah.
I have another question for you. And that is 971.081C says that the circuit court, in accepting a plea of guilty or no contest, shall, which is usually mandatory in a statute, address the defendant personally and advise the defendant as follows. If you are not a citizen of the United States, you are advised that a plea of guilty or no contest for the offense with which you are charged may result in deportation, the exclusion from admission to the country, or the denial of naturalization under federal law. Now, the judge never said that to the defendant, right?
That's correct, yes.
Never said that.
Had the judge said that to the defendant, I don't think we would be here right now.
Okay. Number two in that statute says that if a court fails to advise a defendant, as required by the section I just read you, and a defendant later shows that the plea is likely to result in deportation, and here we know it's likely to result in deportation because he's got the visit already
yes.
from the INS, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, if it's likely to result in deportation, the court, on the defendant's motion, shall vacate any applicable judgment against the defendant and permit the defendant to withdraw the plea and enter another plea. Now, that's pretty clear on its face.
Yes, it is.
Says court must do this.
Yes.
Court didn't do this. How can we justify that?
Well, I think you can justify it. Well, I don't think it can be justified. I think the court should have done it. Actually, there have been decisions saying that if the court, if he meets these requirements, he can withdraw his plea if the state doesn't prove that he's understanding of the potential for deportation when he entered his plea. However, I think the statutory wording is pretty clear, and if you strictly apply that he should be entitled to withdraw his plea because of the fact these warnings haven't been given him and he's met the requirements of showing that deportation proceedings have begun.
Well, you haven't, I don't think, asked that we overrule this line of cases. They're all from the Court of Appeals, aren't they?
I believe they are, yes.
You want us to overrule?
I think they should be overruled, yes. Perhaps that's my error in not being more specific on
it. No, because it's very difficult to have a case overruled, as you know,
yes. mm-hmm.
with stare decisis. So lawyers generally don't like to
yeah.
ask us to overrule cases
yes.
because it looks like a loser.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I try to avoid that. I don't want to recognize anybody by saying something.
I know, that's why I'm doing it.
Okay, well, thank you.
Saving you the effort.
But you've just hit the main point of my argument on the fact that really what the Supreme Court can do here is correct the situation and prevent this problem in the future by allowing him to withdraw his plea.
Did those cases, those Court of Appeals cases that evidently you are now suggesting anyway might be overrulable under the statute, involve defendants who made the statutory showing that they were likely to be deported?
I don't recall whether they specifically made them or just what was done on that as far as the factual situation. But
so maybe we can distinguish them.
You might be able to distinguish them, yes. I hadn't really sat down and looked at this and that should be overruled. I didn't feel that was what I should be presenting. I'm trying to present things in the benefit of Cisco Home.
But are you saying then, regardless of whether there's actual notice or not, actual understanding by your client, it makes no difference because the judge should have followed 97108? So that's regardless. So if you go back for the hearing, which was held, and there was a finding by the court that he... there was an actual understanding, because you can see that the effect, if the court would say, we'll never use actual understanding, you have to have strict compliance with the statute, that there could be many situations, not just involving deportation, but many other so-called language difficulties where it was clear that it may have been understood, but there wasn't a strict compliance with 971.
Now, I don't think this necessarily would affect other situations and other statutes. We're wording, talking about specific wording in the statute.
Yes.
The statute sets out the exact words that should be used, even as quotation marks around them, which is sort of a clear sign, I think, that the legislature intended that these warnings be given. And it's not a case of either you give these warnings or prove that he understood he could be deported. Statute doesn't give that option. It just says that these warnings must be given. If they aren't, he then has the right to withdraw his plea.
That's why the question before this, the Chief Justice was asking what we should do with these cases, and because that's the line of cases that allow and talk about what the actual knowledge, actual understanding of the individual was.
Well, I believe some of the cases that would be in that line of cases involve other type of situations regarding understanding, not whether there was specific statutory wording as there is here, but there are some that do apply to deportation when the warning wasn't given. And, quite frankly, I think these decisions are in conflict with the wording of the statute and the intent of the legislature.
Counsel, with regard to the intent of the legislature, the Chavez case, which is the case mm-hmm. that takes us on this avenue of harmless error approach, there, as I recall, the Court of Appeals said that the statute that we're discussing is ambiguous and that you should look to the legislative intent. And they said the legislature sought to alleviate hardship and unfairness involved when an alien unwittingly pleads guilty or no contest without being informed of the consequences, and therefore emphasized the importance that they had actual knowledge, it wasn't unwitting, and therefore the intent to only assist those unwitting would be affected. How do you respond to that argument in Chavez?
Well, it's hard to respond directly to it. I think obviously there is a conflict here. There is a question whether or not a person understands that he can be deported, whether that should be sufficient, or whether the statutory warning is given. I think one of the problems that we're having in cases like this is that you do have pretty much a gray area here, and the best way to solve it would be to require that statutory wording be given in every case. That would eliminate any problems or any discussion about did he or did he not understand. It's pretty hard to go back, like in this case, later on, and try to determine what was in his mind when he entered the plea. Particularly, part of the problem is here you're dealing with people generally in this instance that have a very limited understanding of the English knowledge. And the case is going to come up, this type of situation in the future, particularly because of the arrival of so many non-citizen residents, of not just Laotians, but Hmongs, Spanish, other nationalities, that have different cultures, different languages, and really don't understand our legal and judicial system, and have limited understanding of English. That this problem will keep coming up, and that this really only can be prevented if the court requires that the trial courts comply with the statutory mandate of 97108(1)(c) by giving the deportation record warning so that the record can clearly establish the defendant understood the possibility of deportation. I think that basically is the basis for our request here.
What happens when you have a case involving a double homicide, a couple of gruesome murders, and the person, same kind of facts in terms of knowledge of the English language as we have here, same record as we have here. Are you suggesting if the judge doesn't say verbatim what's in the quotation marks, that the defendant should be allowed to withdraw his plea?
Well, I believe that would be the situation. However, the fact that the defendant withdraws his plea doesn't mean he walks out of the prison. Same way with Siscombe. It means it goes back to the court to make certain he understood that. He still may end up in the same situation. If there's evidence that he committed these serious crimes, then he's still going to be convicted. Or maybe he's going to plead or something, but at least his rights have been protected by having the court specifically give him the statutory wording. It isn't going to turn people loose from the prisons. It's just going to see that they understood that they could be deported when they entered no contest plea. And it may affect what they do. In many instances, plea bargains and things where people are maybe agreeing to something, not knowing that. I think there's a situation that's going to occur in the future, and this would be an opportunity for the court to correct that and make it clear. We've got a conflict between the court decisions and the statutory wording, and I think it's important that the court clarify what must be done here before a plea is accepted. And I think this is an excellent opportunity for the court to do that.
Well, the state makes the argument that basically this is harmless error, and what's your position on that? Is that an argument that we should accept?
No, I don't believe it is. I don't think you can really consider it to be harmless error, considering the consequences.
Well, if the evidence is so overwhelming that, let's say we know, and I think Justice Bradley brought this up, we have a double homicide. It's just the evidence is overwhelming, and now we're going to go through the entire trial system again, and the tremendous cost, and et cetera, when the result will be the same.
Well, even if the evidence is overwhelming, that person is going to be convicted, whether he is allowed to withdraw his plea or not, and he's going to receive the appropriate punishment. Certainly there may be some problems along that line, but in most instances, I think what you'd find happen, he can withdraw his plea. Probably the plea was entered after some plea bargaining or something like that, a plea of no contest. That process still can continue. This isn't going to mean that there's going to necessarily have to be lengthy trials and things in every case like this. And I think once the trial courts are aware that they must give this warning, this situation shouldn't arise in the future. I think it'll save more time and problems for the appellate courts if the court does require that the mandate and the statute must be followed in every case.
Mr. Flatley, do you know what the status is of the deportation proceedings? We know that your client was notified that the government was proceeding with deportation.
I don't know just what's happening on them. I believe there's some type of document served on him and filed, if I recall. I didn't represent him on it. There was an attorney from Madison that was working with him. And I don't know, I haven't heard lately as to what the status of anything is being done, or whether they wait until he's been serving his prison time and then deport him, or how they proceed him. I'm not really that familiar with the deportation proceedings.
To the best of your knowledge, he's still in prison here in Wisconsin.
Yes, I hear from him fairly often. He's still in prison. Yesterday would have been his 23rd birthday in prison, and he still has trouble with English, although he's now learned prison English as well as street English, and he can write some awfully nasty letters complaining about his situation.
Counsel, the state in its brief in footnote 1 says the defendant does not raise any issue as to the applicability of harmless error analysis in its brief in chief, and that you did not broach the issue in your petition for review, nor did you raise the issue in the Court of Appeals. It goes on to state in that footnote, if this court nevertheless determines that this case requires it to reevaluate the applicability of harmless error, they want to do additional briefing. I hear in your argument today that's what you're asking, that we should stick with what you would assert to be the plain language of the statute and not engage
yes.
in harmless
yes.
error.
Yes, that's correct.
You think we need additional briefing, counsel?
No, I don't.
Where have you briefed that issue?
On the harmless error?
Whether or not the state, whether or not this court should engage in a harmless error, Bangert sort of analysis. In fact, as I read your brief, and certainly the totality of your reply brief,
it is consistent, it seems to me, with endorsing harmless error in Bangert analysis.
No, I have not done any briefing on harmless error question. I didn't feel that that was an issue. It was a question of whether or not these statutory warnings should have been given. If they should be given, then it isn't harmless error if they're not given. I think that's a major principle that would be addressed here. It's not just whether in this case there was a harmless error, but the future would hold with this type of warning.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Shanette T. Campbell, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, arguing for the state. Ms. Campbell?
May it please the court. This court should affirm the Court of Appeals decision, affirming the trial court's judgment of conviction and order denying post-conviction relief, because the trial court's findings that the state did present clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Doug Malia did understand and have actual knowledge that deportation was a collateral consequence of his no contest plea, those findings were not clearly erroneous. Concerning the standard of review, the law is clear as set forth in State versus ESA. ESA specifically states that whether a defendant has made a prima facie showing that his plea was defective is a question of law, which is reviewed independently. The state concedes that the deportation warning was not given as mandated by 971081C. Therefore, per ESA, the defendant was entitled to an evidentiary hearing, not to an automatic withdrawal of his no contest plea, at which the state was required to show by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Doug Malia both understood and knew that deportation was a collateral consequence of his plea.
And was ESA a case that involved a defendant who made an explicit showing of likelihood of deportation?
No, it was not.
Has there been a reported case where the defendant has made that showing, as is the case here, which appears, at least on the face of the statute, to trigger the automatic withdrawal?
That argument was made in State versus Baeza, that he was presumed deportable due to the nature of the crime of first-degree sexual assault. And in that case, the court decided that deportation remained a collateral consequence even in face of that, that it was not transformed into a direct consequence even when the defendant says, I'm presumed deportable, because when a separate body has the decision-making power, it's not defined as a direct consequence, which is wholly automatic or would flow directly from the conviction.
Why do we apply that analysis where there's an explicit statute that requires these warnings to be given and specifies a remedy, which is automatic withdrawal of the plea?
As a matter of public policy, as stated in the holding in Chavez, in line with the legislative history where they want to protect immigrants or non-citizens who would unwittingly enter a plea, they state it is not meant to be a windfall to a defendant who was actually aware of the deportation consequences of his plea. It's an equitable remedy, and it is in line with the legislative intent.
Isn't that analysis, though, the analysis about collateral consequences versus direct consequences applied where the statute doesn't specify a remedy? For example, you know, in the case of felony gun warnings and other sorts of things where certain warnings are required to be given, but there is no legislatively prescribed remedy for the failure to give those warnings, and then the court engages in that sort of analysis to determine what the appropriate remedy is and whether a harmless analysis, direct or collateral consequence analysis, should be applied to determine the appropriate remedy. So that line of cases arguably has no application here because we have an explicit statutorily prescribed remedy.
That's true, but the state would hold that, or the state would argue that the long line of cases applying the harmless error analysis is correct. That here, when you look at the legislative intent, it's just clear that they did not mean this to be a windfall to defendants. So I think that in line with the legislative intent, even with the wording of the statute when you take it together with the legislative intent, that the harmless error analysis is correct.
Okay. I'm not really sure what you mean when you refer to legislative intent. The legislative intent is found in the language of the statute itself, and the language of the statute says that if the defendant makes the showing, the court shall vacate the plea. And there's no question in this case that the defendant made the showing. He's going to be deported. He's been served with papers by the INS, and they have found him deportable and initiated proceedings. And the language of the statute is therefore mandatory. So how can you argue a contrary legislative intent?
Well, looking at the drafting notes, say, that I have here.
Well, first of all, why do we go to drafting notes in the first place if the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous and says shall withdraw the plea?
I would suppose, as the court did, to ascertain what the underlying, really the underlying purpose and intent of the legislature was, even though you seem to have uncontrovertible language here. There is the drafting notes and the legislative history often lends more understanding of the legislature's intent.
Okay, even
seemingly, there does seem to be a direct consequence here, but that is not how it's been applied, and that is not what Mr. Dukmala has argued for the overturning of that harmless error analysis. And the state would, you know, I'm not actually prepared to make a full argument on that today. We did ask in our brief for supplemental briefing on that issue because there would be such a colossal change in overturning about 10 years of precedent that applies to harmless error in Garcia and Rodriguez and Lopez and Issa and Chavez and all of the seminal cases in this area.
But all of those seminal cases involve defendants who either could not or did not make the showing that they were likely to be deported. And so of harmless error perhaps was not inappropriate.
Well, actually, in Baeza, you do have someone who's, you know, the prime candidate for deportation due to the crime that he committed, and the court still decided that the harmless error analysis was appropriate.
In Baeza, the court said harmless error was appropriate?
Yes.
Because I thought that the focus was on, as you indicate, the likelihood of deportation and that showing. And as I read that case, I didn't think that it employed the harmless error analysis. In fact, I think, isn't there a footnote in Issa that says, that recognizes that, and that Chavez was the one that started the harmless error? I may be wrong. That's my recollection, that Baeza was not a harmless error case.
Well, actually, because that Baeza failed to show that the plea was likely to result in his deportation,
mm-hmm.
so he did not meet the second prong. But as far as it being a collateral consequence,
yeah.
the court here does still...
Indeed, it's a collateral consequence, and I think both parties agree that...
However,
which is another interesting issue, whether or not deporting someone depriving them of their liberty in potentially a very, very substantial way is a collateral consequence to a plea. But that aside, since that isn't the issue before us, boy, as I read Baeza, I didn't see that as endorsing a harmless error approach.
However, if it remains a collateral consequence and you do not have a right to be informed of collateral consequences, then it would then follow logically that it would be subjected to harmless error.
Doesn't that only go to the issue of whether the plea was otherwise knowing and voluntary under Bangert and that line of cases, which is always available as a basis to attack a plea?
Well, actually, the Bangert analysis wouldn't apply because of the fact that the subsections 1C and 2 were not in play at the time the Bangert decision was determined, and that's found in Rodriguez at page 494. It says, since Bangert was decided, we have held that when a defendant claims that notice was not of possible deportation was not given per 1C, the defendant is entitled to withdraw the plea under sub 2 if the state does not prove that the omission was harmless or that the defendant did not, in fact, have an understanding. So the Bangert court prior to 1985, when the sub C was added, then the Bangert remedy would be applied, but not to subsections amended to the statute after that.
Well, forgetting about Rodriguez for a minute, what's wrong with the argument made by Mr. Flatley? He says basically, look, you've got a situation where this fellow never would have entered a plea of no contest if he had known that he was going to be deported back to Laos. Therefore, his plea is not a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary one, and therefore we have a standard of review that ultimately is de novo. What's wrong with that?
Well, actually, under either standard, the state would prevail because in a de novo review, this court would still look at the record, the facts of the record as they were found by the trial court. And we have a strong record here where we have the attorney representing Mr. Doug Malia stating over and over again throughout the record that it was her normal practice to go over everything in the plea forms with a defendant, and she would not have deviated from that, especially when there are language difficulties. So even under looking at the facts as they existed de novo, they would still be looked at as they are, as they exist in a record.
Well, Ms. Stoltman, who was the attorney at the time, never indicates that she has an independent recollection of discussing deportation with the defendant. She never indicates that she explained the word deportation to him, and he says he didn't understand what deportation meant. So how do you have such a strong record?
Actually, at Record 16, which is the actual plea form, at question 17, the words are underlined as well as having Mr. Doug Malia's initials. So therefore, that would indicate that the content and the words and content of the question were emphasized. And so that would negate his testimony that he signed everything, he went over every question, he just can't remember this specific one.
Are all the words in 17 underlined or just put deportation?
No contest is underlined. So it would tend to show some emphasis.
But that shows that the attorney underlined the nature of the plea. That's all that shows.
As she went over it with the defendant. So even though she doesn't have the independent recollection of going over it, having his initials and having her underlined or him underlined shows that somebody was emphasizing that. So it would tend to negate the testimony.
Deportation is an underline in this.
Deportation is an underline, but it would tend to show that they went over that question, whereas Mr. Doug Malia says that he has no recollection of going over the question at all.
Counsel, I just wanted to go back to Justice Sykes' question of a few moments ago on the statute itself, and the Chief Justice asked under 97108, she talked about this with opposing counsel. Now, the court, and I know there are various views on this, whether you should use legislative history, we should just take the plain language, but here, I know nothing other than what we have in the briefs on this, and under the statute, under 97108.1, we're looking at 1C, that the defendant, if he can show that it's likely to result in deportation, and here that is obviously what is going on, and that the court on the defendant's motion shall vacate if the court itself, and here the court never gave any admonition, anything. So you're saying, but from the record, and now we're talking about the record here, all of us, and the record is showing that there was no independent recollection from defense counsel that she specifically, let's say, advised him. And she says, it's my practice to do that. But when you have both of these things, it's in the area of harmless error, you're asking for a supplemental brief, but it's hard for the court, at least hard for me, to understand why we should not be taking the viewpoint that the statute means what it says. In other words, shall means shall. Is there something, you said legislative history, that says shall is may?
Well, actually, our bill was modeled on the Texas bill, which says that a trial court's failure to inform a defendant of collateral consequences of a plea does not require that the conviction be vacated when the plea's immigration result is later ascertained. So it would show that they, modeling it on this existing bill from Texas, that they had the same intent to protect the non-citizen, but not to give him a windfall.
Why did they use the word shall, then?
That I would have to look further into and research further, but I think taken as a whole, looking at the legislative intent, looking at the precedent, looking at how the public policy behind it, that we do not want people who, as you said, committed a double murder to walk based on a technicality.
So they don't walk in the sense they get another opportunity.
But using judicial resources for no better reason than a technicality, when there is evidence produced, clear and convincing evidence produced, that they had actual knowledge and understood the consequence of that plea.
Could I ask you a question? Are you familiar with State versus Tyron Anderson?
No, I am not. Well, the court inform me?
This was a recent court case in which the statute authorized the waiver of a jury trial in writing, and that was done. But this court said it wasn't enough. There had to be a colloquy. But let me just simply ask you, suppose the court were to say, we're going to interpret the statute literally. If you don't give that warning, pretty much in substance the way it's in the statute, the plea can be withdrawn. What are the evil consequences that will flow from that?
Well, one is that there's the windfall issue, that people will disingenuously say that they didn't understand just to get out of the result of their plea. Also, it would not solve the problem, as one person asked. If you don't understand certain words, giving them in rote fashion isn't going to increase the understanding. Therefore, the state will argue that the better remedy is the one that exists, the equitable remedy, where you have a full evidentiary hearing, where you take testimony from counsel, testimony from the defendant, as in this case, and then you make a determination, because the trial court is in the best position to make a determination on witness credibility. That remedy is the best remedy, the state would argue.
Well, so if I could play the devil's advocate, you talked about judicial resources a moment ago. If the warning were given as the statute requires, then you presumably wouldn't need these evidentiary hearings to determine whether the defendant really understood. Isn't that correct?
True, but a remedy must exist in the rare cases where the warning is not given.
Well, isn't this statute specifically says if you are not a citizen of the United States, so that whether he understood or not, but the court, we're not talking about understanding, we're simply saying that if you're not a citizen and you have been advised, and we're talking about deportation, so isn't the trigger here not only not understanding, but more so that this person was not a citizen, and in the plea colloquy it talked about deportation, and there is a specific statute. So it seems to me this is a little different than whether he really understood, because it was specifically mandated because he was not a citizen, and that was known to the court.
That is true, and the court did have an extensive colloquy with him to make sure that he was able to proceed, and just like the point to the Court of Appeals ruling on that, where they state that he did not meet any of the criteria for necessitating that he would specifically have to have an interpreter. The trial court didn't just run through this. They did carefully determine that he was not in need of an interpreter.
Counsel, let me take your issue and your standard of review. And your issue essentially is stated as is the finding of the trial court. Has to show, or has to be shown, that he had actual knowledge. And what's the burden of proof on that? Clear and convincing evidence?
Yes.
Does this record, given some of the questions of my colleagues that indicate that the attorney could not recall what she did, but testified regarding her normal practice, that the defendant said she did not, that the plea information questionnaire indicates he understood 20% of his ability to read, write, and understand English. Does that record meet your own test that there is clear, satisfactory, and convincing evidence that he had actual knowledge?
Yes, it does, and I'll tell you why. At page 20 of the record, Ms. Stoltzman stated, and I quote, "I have a tendency to go through a lot of detail, particularly regarding rights, penalties, and consequences of a plea offer," and she's adamant and she maintains that throughout. She just doesn't say, "I have no recollection, and but my normal practice would have been to go over the entire
form." And that's what the trial court really hangs on. It seemed to me in reading that transcript that he believed that she, in fact, he said, "She practices before me and she's thorough," and she said she normally does this, and so then he inferred, apparently, by clear and convincing burden, that that's what happened in this case, so that he had actual knowledge that he would be deported. Is that your understanding of the underpinnings of the trial court's opinion?
Not only that, partially so, but not only that, is also the fact that the court noted at page 48 that Ms. Stoltzman went over the offer from the state, the no contest plea, and the plea questionnaire for a total of 6 hours with Mr. Jugmalia.
Let me ask, in preparing for this, one of the things that bothered me is that 20% that I have emphasized in my last question. Indeed, there's testimony from the attorney that she wrote, obviously, the 20%, because there's testimony that he has difficulty reading and writing. So she wrote the 20%, and she thought that was accurate. And I'll tell you what clicked with me this morning, and that is, I took Spanish in college, and I've taken a couple of brief refreshers over the many years since college. And I would guess, in all honesty, that my ability to speak Spanish is about 20% and with help. And mine is just like that, 20% and with help. I certainly do not feel that I in any way would be qualified to attend a sentencing that could sentence me to prison up to 25 years, as this sentencing did, subject me to deportation on a 20% and with help understanding of the Spanish language. That would be craziness for me. How do you respond? And apparently that's what's going on here.
I would agree, but the facts here are a little different. Mr. Jugmalia did go through the ninth grade here in America, and was exposed to English speakers all the time, and he also had an attorney that had met with him 16 to 17 times having conferences and went over a form that might take anyone who's proficient in English 10 minutes at the most to go over. She went over it with him for 6 hours. So in the context of her representation, I would find that there's clear and convincing evidence that he both knew and understood, because she emphasizes in her testimony that we spent a lot of time in communication so that I was sure in my mind that I was successful and that I gave Siska Home the opportunity to ask me any questions that he might have. And she reiterates that throughout her testimony.
And apparently a very good and conscientious person. I'm just bothered by that she has no independent recollection of what she did here.
That actually makes sense, because the plea was entered September 21st, 1998, and the evidentiary hearing, due to the multiple appeals, was not conducted until September 19th, 2000. So with attorneys having literally hundreds of cases a year, it would be reasonable that she wouldn't have the independent recollection.
Counsel, I've tried to piece together the various Court of Appeals cases, And you're looking at the legislative history is right in keeping with the Court of Appeals, as I understand it, in the Chavez case, as repeated with approval in the Isaac case. And it says that the statute's consistent with harmless error, and it says that although literally the subsection 2 could be read to mean what it states, when read in conjunction with 971.26, it can be read to mean you need prejudice. So you're right in line with the Court of Appeals, as I understand it. Now, the Court of Appeals in Rodriguez says a defendant is entitled to withdraw the plea under 971.082 if, and then it has two requirements. One, that if you didn't get the warning, which he did not hear, that the state has to prove the omission was harmless. That is, that the defendant, in fact, had an understanding of the potential of deportation. So the harmless error comes in, and did he understand it? Okay. Do you agree with that?
I agree.
And then it says the defendant is entitled to withdraw the plea under sub 2 if the requirements of 971.082 are met. Now, it seems to me in this case, subsection 2 is met.
It's met on the second prong that he was actually found to be deportable by the INS, a separate body. But however, he does not make it on the first prong that he shows, because there is evidence in the record that he both knew and understood.
So you read Rodriguez as a two-prong test, and if you miss out on either prong, you're out of here. And they put in harmless error under the first part, 1C.
Yes.
So when you read Chavez, it would indicate it's under 2 also, but you don't read it that way.
Either works well.
Meaning it works, right? That's right, and you don't have to do that here because we have met subsection 2. I want to go back to your footnote 1 in your brief,
yes.
Counsel. If we go into the harmless error analysis here, which I read to really be a review, an entire review of the Court of Appeals cases because of this two-prong test, you asked for additional briefs.
Yes.
You still make that request, Counsel?
I will still make the request.
What about the whole issue of interpreters? I mean, the statute apparently may not have been followed here, of giving him an interpreter.
Well, let me just quickly find the Court of Appeals decision on that.
Okay. This was the first Court of Appeals decision that
yes.
then sent it back to a subsequent hearing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Do you view that as a dead issue here?
Yes, I do, for the following reasons. The Court of Appeals said that, and I'll just quote, Dugmalia has shown no blanket need for an interpreter at the plea hearing. At the post-sentencing stage, Dugmalia needed to show a manifest injustice to withdraw his plea. As to the interpreter, the trial court needed to inquire at the plea hearing only if it had cause to believe that Dugmalia was incapable of communicating with counsel, 1, 2, understanding testimony, and 3, or being understood himself. We note that Dugmalia never moved to withdraw his plea specifically on this ground. And he cites it, however, but they, in short, say that, in short, Dugmalia has shown no blanket need for an interpreter because he did not meet those three criteria. And the state would agree with that.
Thank you, Counsel.
Let me ask, is there any place in the record that you can point me to where there was, after the request for an interpreter, both at the scheduled preliminary hearing and then the subsequent waiver of preliminary hearing, is there any place in the record that you can point me to that shows a personal and voluntary waiver of the right to an interpreter?
I cannot. I could give a report on that. I cannot at this point. I see that my time is up. May I conclude?
Yes, you may. If I could follow up briefly on that issue. When a plea questionnaire says on its face that the defendant has only 20% English competence, and that is primitive and only with help, doesn't that put the trial court on notice under the interpreter statute 885.37.1b that the trial court's got a person with the limited language ability under that statute so as to require the specific factual findings that are mandated by that statute or an express waiver as noted by Justice Bradley early on in the case?
Yes, and the Court of Appeals did mention that they did not follow the mandate in 885.371B on whether Mr. Dukmala's English language ability required an interpreter, and in spite of that, they made that following the ruling that I just quoted. However, the court did decide by its own colloquy with Mr. Dukmala that he was fine to proceed without the interpreter.
So it would be your position that the remedy under that statute is a post hoc evaluation of the defendant's English speaking ability?
Well, I think,
and a harmless error analysis?
Yes, I think from the trial court standpoint, they are in the best position to determine his credibility as a witness, and they found him not to be credible in his denials of understanding English and understanding the specific deportation warning that he had knowledge. And they were with him in the trial court, and they were with him through all proceedings, so they are in the best position to judge that. Just looking at the plea form, it might look pretty grim, but when you take it in its totality, the record in its totality is clear from the testimony of Attorney Stoltzman, from his own testimony, and from the findings of the trial court that Mr. Dukmala had actual knowledge and understood the consequences of his plea.
Did the defendant have an interpreter at the post-conviction hearing on remand from the Court of Appeals?
No, he did not.
Did he ask for one?
No, he did not. May I conclude?
You may conclude, briefly.
The record supports the trial court's findings that Mr. Dukmala had actual knowledge and understood that his no contest plea could result in his deportation, and these findings are not clearly erroneous. Therefore, the state respectfully requests that this court affirm the Court of Appeals decision affirming the judgment and conviction and order of the trial court denying post-conviction relief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Flatley, rebuttal.
Okay. Well,
counsel, before you begin, can I ask you right up front, did you handle the post-conviction motion hearing on remand from the Court of Appeals?
Yes, I did.
Why didn't you request an interpreter in this case for your client?
I don't think the subject ever came. He had been denied interpreter in the past, and then he had not continued that motion when it got to the trial court, and at that point there probably wasn't as much need for an interpreter as there would have been at an earlier stage in the proceedings. At the post-conviction motion hearing, it was a case where the only testimony came from the state had his trial attorney testify at length, and then I had him testify. I think at that point he understood the situation in English well enough that he could. He had a couple more years of practice in learning English by then, too. And
by this point he knows what deportation is, right?
What? Yeah, he learned the hard way what deportation was. But, I mean, perhaps I was wrong in not doing that in retrospect now.
Counsel, it did come up, though, at the post-conviction motion hearing, as I read the transcript, and the question asked by his attorney, Lassay,
assistant DA, yes.
The assistant DA of the trial counsel, and she responded, I requested an interpreter and that the prelim was adjourned to have a Laotian interpreter appointed by the court. That never happened. Question, and it didn't happen because of a failure in the process? Answer, failure of the process. The court said it could not find a Laotian interpreter, and I don't have the transcript, but my client, I think, got out of frustration. But regardless, this doesn't quite make sense, but I'm reading it verbatim. And I think my client got out of frustration, but regardless, I said that there was no interpreter. I believe he agreed to proceed without an interpreter.
I recall from reviewing the transcript of the waiver preliminary hearing, there was discussion about it. This was before a court commissioner, not before the judge, and at that point, he indicated he wanted to proceed without it. They say I wasn't there at that period, but...
the old transcripts speak for themselves.
Yes,
whatever they say,
yeah.
They say. Yes, okay.
But I just wanted to mention that I don't feel the clearly erroneous test is the appropriate standard of review to be applied, as the state is suggesting. There are recent Supreme Court decisions, Bolick and Burge cases, that hold that reaffirm the issue of whether a plea was voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently entered is a question of constitutional fact, which the appellate court would review independently of the conclusions of the lower court. So you're not just reviewing here whether or not the lower court was correct. The appropriate standard of appellate review, then, is whether the state has met its burden of proof at the evidentiary hearing to establish by clear and convincing evidence that the plea was knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered. And I think in this case, the state hadn't met that burden. There certainly was still a question as to whether the plea was knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily entered, and that under such circumstances, he should be permitted to withdraw his plea and have it returned to the trial court.
Does knowing, intelligent, and voluntary apply to something like deportation, where there's a collateral, it's a collateral to the plea, and there's no constitutional right to be advised of it?
Well, the constitutional right is whether is to have a plea knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered, and the actually the statute requiring this warning to be given is collateral, but it really is in support of the constitutional issue that the plea must be knowingly, voluntarily, intelligently entered. So it fits in with it. It's still a collateral issue, but we're going to the fact of the way the plea was entered. And so I think that would apply. Anything further?
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Flatley. Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Before I call a close to this hearing, I want to introduce the court to you and make some other introductions. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Seated to my immediate left is